Die Übersetzung von Jans Stimme vom Deutschen ins Englische wurde mit einer KI erstellt.
The air is full of drones over the trenches, over the gravel roads, over every dirt track leading to the front. In Ukraine, soldiers now speak of a kill zone stretching 20 kilometers deep, some even say 40. Anyone moving there knows that any movement could be their last. And right in the middle of this kill zone, new machines are moving, ground drones, tracked vehicles loaded with ammunition, water and food. Some of them are armed and some are used to evacuate wounded soldiers from the kill zone who would otherwise have no chance of survival. In this episode of Crisis Mode, we want to take a closer look at how profoundly these drones have changed the war in Ukraine. What does it actually mean when ground robots suddenly become mass-produced? How close are we to those images, AI-driven drones, combat robots, a Terminator on the battlefield? And what does all of this mean for us in Europe?
Ohne Drohnenunterstützung ein Angriff.
Without drone support, organizing an attack or a defense is essentially a suicide mission.
Konnte ein Himmelfahrtskommando.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
I'm Jan Jessen, war and crisis reporter for the Funke Media Group. In this episode, we're picking up on a conversation many of you have already heard. Putin's drones over Europe, how big is the threat, was the title of that episode, and we'll link it for you again in the show notes. Back then, we spoke with military expert Gustav Gressel about drones, about airports, power plants and barracks, about reconnaissance flights and Russia's political testing. Today, we're taking it a step further, moving closer to the front line in Ukraine. As we've discussed several times on this podcast, the war in Ukraine has changed dramatically in recent years. It has now been raging for 4 years, and the technology has transformed completely. At the beginning, when I first traveled there after the start of the Russian invasion, there were a few reconnaissance drones in the air directing artillery. Now, drones have become one of the most important weapons, if not the most important. As I mentioned earlier, drones now dominate the airspace directly over the front. Long-range drones attack Ukrainian cities every night. And on the other side, the Ukrainians use long-range drones every night to strike Russia's energy infrastructure, oil and gas production, in an effort to weaken the Russian war machine. There are surface drones, underwater drones, and when I was last there in the Kramatorsk area, in eastern Ukraine, I stood with soldiers from the 101st Brigade in a wooded area near the city. Kramatorsk is one of the last two major cities in the Donetsk region still held by Ukrainian forces. The 101st is actually a guard brigade of the general staff, but it is now also deployed on the front line. There they showed me a ground robot, the droid TW-12.7. The 12.7 refers to the caliber of the weapon mounted on this tracked vehicle, a heavy Browning machine gun, as I said, caliber 12.7. They use it as a combat robot, but the platform carrying that Browning is also used for many other purposes, transporting ammunition to the front as well as water and food, and sometimes evacuating the wounded. That's the machine I saw there, the one they showed me. It's used for firing. But how new is this? And at what scale are we now talking about these kinds of systems? That's what I asked Gustav Gressel. He is a military expert at the National Defense Academy of the Austrian Armed Forces in Vienna. And you may already know him from our podcast. We've done several episodes with him. We'll also link everything we've done with him in the show notes.
Ja, wir sehen sie natürlich hauptsächlich in der Ukraine. Also andere Fahrzeuge benutzen auch robotische Kettenfahrzeuge, aber in viel geringerem Ausmaß.
Yes, we naturally see them mainly in Ukraine. Other armed forces also use robotic tracked vehicles, but on a much smaller scale. The first application was actually in mine clearing operations, either to remove mines or for more specialized demining tasks. For example, sending tracked robots equipped with cameras into buildings suspected of being mined. They would first take images, map the interior spaces, and only then decide how to clear the structure. In combat or logistical roles, however, these tracked robots have now become mass-produced in Ukraine. Last year alone, Ukraine produced around 12,000 ground robots. This year, the goal is 50,000. In terms of quantity, this far exceeds what has previously been deployed by other countries such as the United States or Israel.
Also, das ist sozusagen von der Quantität her weit größer als das, was bisher von anderen Staaten, USA, Israel, eingesetzt wurde.
15,000 ground robots last year alone. The target is 50,000. That's an industrial scale that we in Europe are still far from reaching. And these robots aren't operating on some testing ground. They're deployed in the middle of a war in which drones, as I said, have become one of the most important categories of weapons. Every month, tens of thousands of drones are produced. FPV drones, these kamikaze drones operating at the front, reconnaissance drones, bomber drones, long-range drones, as well as surface and underwater drones. They're built in Ukraine itself and also supplied from abroad. The UK, for example, recently announced it plans to deliver 120,000 drones to Ukraine. As I said, these have now become one of the key weapons. What that actually means in practice is something I witnessed near the front line around Kramatorsk, where the front is still about 10 to 15 kilometers away. You can already see how dangerous the situation has become when driving into Kramatorsk or into the neighboring city of Sloviansk. For kilometers, you drive through what are essentially net tunnels, protective coverings stretched over the roads to shield civilian vehicles still moving through the area, as well as military vehicles from Russian drone attacks. It's a makeshift solution, and driving through it feels quite oppressive. You're effectively inside a kind of tunnel made of fishing nets. And sometimes you can see where drones have struck. There are holes torn into the nets above, and occasionally the remains of drones are still hanging there. All of this shows just how dramatically things have changed due to drone warfare. We were near Kramatorsk in a small wooded area, meeting with soldiers. At some point, a large transport vehicle arrived, and then this drone rattled out. At first glance, it actually looked quite cute, not particularly large, more like those small mini excavators you often see on construction sites, maybe 2 or 3 meters long, very compact in appearance. And that's exactly how this drone came across. But then you noticed the machine gun mounted on it, and suddenly it didn't look cute anymore. That made it feel distinctly more threatening. This drone is essentially a platform, a set of tracks with a base unit. Different modules can be mounted onto it. Not all of these ground drones are equipped with machine guns. I asked the officers there, do you really need these ground drones, or are they more of a technological gimmick?
Ну, вони надзвичайно важливі. Це життєво необхідні. Життєво необхідні комплекси, які використовуються в будь-яких сферах, тобто
Yes, these drones are absolutely essential for us. In essence, they're life-saving equipment. We use them to evacuate wounded soldiers, to get out those who need help. We deliver ammunition, supplies, and medicine to forward positions with them. We also use them to lay mines, and they can be used for fire support as well. That means they are truly multifunctional systems, and for us at the front, they're extremely important.
Медикаменти. Що, ну, ми все робимо, мінуємо, проводимо вогневу підтримку наших позицій. Тобто, ну, це дуже багатофункціональні вироби, які застосовуються в багатьох сферах. Тобто
Yes, life-saving equipment, evacuating the wounded, transporting ammunition and supplies, laying mines, providing fire support. All of this can be done with these tracked vehicles. As I said, they're built on a modular system. Not every drone can do everything, but once you have the platform, it can be reconfigured quickly. Most of that conversion work is actually done by the units themselves. And of course, I asked the officer about a particular mission that had stayed with him, whether there was an operation he especially remembered. He didn't want to turn it into some grand heroic story. For him, this is simply everyday reality. But he did go on to describe one evacuation.
Ну, в екстраординарних місій у нас поки що не було. Ну, це звичайна робота. Це евакуація поранених, це життєво необхідні ліки, доставляємо провізію, доставляємо БК, тобто, ну, це така буденна, рутинна робота.
I wouldn't say we constantly have extraordinary missions. Most of it is routine. But one evacuation stayed in my mind. An infantry unit brought a severely wounded soldier to a position and placed him on our ground drone there. It was very difficult because Russian FPV drones were everywhere and Russian reconnaissance was observing the entire area. We then loaded the man onto the drone and drove him 16 kilometers out of there.
Точку евакуації, дуже заважали МФПВ-дрони, дуже заважала розвідка противника. От, це було дуже складно зробити, хлопці піднесли, і далі вже ми під'їхали дроном, загрузили його туди, на дрон загрузили безпосередньо постраждалого і вивезли. Це була евакуація в районі десь 16 кілометрів ми провезли.
That was very difficult. We took the guys and then we helped him with a drone, put him onto the drone and monitored him. That was an evacuation over a distance of 16 kilometers. When talking about Ukraine, it's important to understand that evacuating the wounded has become increasingly difficult, a topic we've touched on several times in this podcast. Drone activity at the front has made it much harder. It's not just that soldiers now face enormous risks simply getting to their positions because there are so many drones in the air. Many are killed on the way in or on the way back. It also creates extreme challenges for evacuating the wounded. Normally, injured soldiers need to be moved out of frontline positions as quickly as possible so they can be treated at stabilization points and then transferred to hospitals. This is especially critical for soldiers who apply tourniquets, those self-applied devices every soldier carries to stop severe bleeding, for example, from shrapnel wounds or arterial injuries. These tourniquets are life-saving because they stop bleeding, but they also need to be removed relatively quickly. Otherwise, the limb, an arm or a leg can die due to the restricted blood flow. Unfortunately, this has become a major problem. Many soldiers are now undergoing amputations because the tourniquets remain in place for too long. This condition is often referred to as tourniquet syndrome, and it's something I'm seeing more and more frequently in Ukraine. That's why these ground robots are not just gadgets. They are often life-saving tools for soldiers. If you can send in a machine to retrieve a wounded soldier, you don't have to risk two or three others who would otherwise have to carry their injured comrade out under fire. And there's another aspect. Drones, not just ground drones, but aerial ones as well, have become essential lifelines for soldiers at the front. Some remain in their positions for 1, 2, 3, sometimes even 4 or 5 months. They can't shower, they can't carry enough supplies, and they often sit in small dugouts, just a few square meters in size, holding out for weeks at a time. They need to be supplied with food, medicine, ammunition. Increasingly, drones are used for this. Large aerial drones can carry several kilograms, up to around 20 kilograms, dropping supplies where needed. But ground drones can carry much more, up to 200 kilograms of supplies to the front. And as mentioned, they are also used to evacuate the wounded from this 20 to 30 kilometer deep kill zone where kamikaze drones attack anything that moves. According to Gressel, Russian forces may now be suffering more dead than wounded simply because many injured soldiers can no longer be evacuated from the battlefield. The distances are too great and the route to collection points is too dangerous. Some of the Ukrainian drones now even have mechanical arms that can lift wounded soldiers onto the platform. But in most cases, it's still their comrades who place the injured soldier onto the drone, press the start button, and then send the tracked vehicle off on its own through the kill zone. Infantry soldiers loading a severely wounded comrade onto a ground drone, Russian FPV drones overhead, Russian reconnaissance everywhere, 16 kilometers, as the officer described, in minus 15 degrees Celsius, 4 hours on a tracked vehicle right through the kill zone. Without these drones, the officer said, the wounded would simply freeze to death. That's one side of the story. Ground robots as improvised ambulances in a world where the routes to the front have become deadly, where evacuation itself has turned into a massive problem. But on the other hand, these systems are only part of a much larger picture. Gressel says Ukraine is only just beginning to learn how to integrate ground and aerial drones with infantry and armored units into coordinated operations.
Die gesteigerte Produktionszahl, das war so, letztes Jahr wurden viele einzelne Systeme erprobt und dieses Jahr will die Ukraine eigentlich.
The increased production numbers mean that last year many individual systems were tested. And this year Ukraine is essentially trying to experiment with how to deploy robots in combination with regular infantry and mechanized forces. They are also testing how to coordinate multiple types of robots together and how to integrate them operationally. A lot of what is currently happening in terms of innovation and learning at the front is actually tactical learning. Figuring out what quantities of which systems are needed for which combat tasks, how the mix has to be structured, and how synchronization between different systems must be achieved in order to be successful.
Bewerkstelligen, damit ich dann zum Erfolg komme.
The drone I looked at there, the Droid TW-12.7, the one equipped with a Browning machine gun, reportedly achieved something quite remarkable. Not this exact machine, but one of the same type, is said to have held a position for about a month and a half. That means the system was deployed to the front line, moved into position, and then effectively secured that area. And according to the soldiers, it managed to do this for around 6 weeks. During that time, it also reportedly engaged in several firefights with Russian soldiers and assault units attempting to break through to the front. At night, the machine would return, be reloaded, its batteries recharged, and then head back out to the same position the next morning. And this cycle is said to have continued for about a month and a half, as the soldiers I spoke with told me. More recently, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that for the first time, a Russian position had been captured exclusively using unmanned systems. In other words, these machines were not just used defensively to hold a position, they were used in an offensive operation. And of course, that sounds almost like science fiction, a war without soldiers in direct combat. I asked Gustav Gressel whether this is actually realistic or whether it's more likely to be propaganda.
Die Ukraine erprobt solche Angriffsmethoden. Bei den rein robotischen Angriffen muss das Gelände auch irgendwann halten.
Yes, Ukraine is experimenting with such offensive methods. In purely robotic attacks, however, the terrain still has to be held at some point. Eventually, infantry has to move in. So there is usually a transition between robotic control and human control, and drawing clear boundaries between the two is difficult. What is interesting is that in these seven phases of a Ukrainian attack, only the last two phases are actually carried out by regular mechanized infantry, armored infantry units, known in Germany as Panzergrenadier, and physical troops. In the early phases, conventional artillery still plays a limited role, but for the most part, drones dominate. Reconnaissance and attack drones, electronic warfare systems, electronic intelligence systems, and similar technologies.
Aufklärungsangriffsdrohnen, Systeme der elektronischen Kampfführung, elektronische Aufklärungssysteme, etc. eine Rolle.
Yes, that may be the big reality check when it comes to robotic attacks. In the end, humans still have to go into the terrain. There always need to be soldiers who physically hold ground and who, when it comes to taking or securing territory, push forward to ensure that it is actually controlled. So the real question is less about when machines will fully replace humans and more about how drones can prepare the battlefield and how they change the nature of war. When you talk to drone operators in Ukraine, and we've done that several times for this podcast, you constantly hear the same idea. In the future, drones may only receive a mission objective and artificial intelligence will handle everything else. What does that mean? The theory is that drones would eventually be equipped with small onboard computers or controlled by them that are AI-driven. That could solve many of the current problems on the battlefield when it comes to drones. Right now, the biggest issue is that many drones are still radio-controlled. That makes them vulnerable to jamming and disruption through electronic warfare. This wouldn't be the case if the drone had its own small brain, so to speak. In that scenario, there would be no need for pilots anymore. The drone would simply receive a mission and a tactical objective, then set off on the ground or in the air and carry out that mission autonomously. It's a chilling idea, of course, because in practical terms, it would also mean that a drone could ultimately decide on its own what counts as a legitimate target, what is a high-value target, and it could also decide to kill people independently from an ethical perspective that is extremely difficult, even though in war one always has to ask how ethical warfare can ever be in the first place. I asked Kessel whether this is just a dream or a nightmare, or whether we are actually close to seeing these visions from Ukrainian engineers and soldiers become reality.
Aber bis wir dahin kommen, dauert es noch eine Zeit. Also wir erinnern uns an die Medienberichterstattung über zum Beispiel die Helsinki Hikes 2, die angeblich nicht funktioniert hätte.
But we're still some way away from that. We can all remember media reports about systems like the Helsing HX2, which allegedly did not work properly. Leaving aside the fact that some of the reporting was exaggerated, the underlying issue was real. The software designed to identify targets and guide drones without a direct radio link, especially in conditions of heavy jamming or GPS disruption, works very well on firing ranges and training grounds. But in real combat, the other side is trying to survive and is not a clear, easily identifiable target. Depending on how Russian forces behave, how they camouflage themselves, how they distort the silhouette of their vehicles to confuse computer vision, there were significant gaps in performance. And this didn't just affect Helsing, which was highlighted in the media. It also affected many Ukrainian drone manufacturers working on the same problems. The computational requirements and programming demands in real combat turned out to be much higher than what had been assumed in testing or laboratory development. It took about a year to solve these software issues and refine the systems for real-world use. The second major challenge is bandwidth, especially with drone swarms, of which there are currently very few or none in actual deployment. Large amounts of radio communication are required, and radio is the Achilles heel of drone warfare. It can be jammed or at least detected and used to trace the origin of a signal and locate where the opponent is launching from. This means both sides are trying to minimize radio transmissions as much as possible. Coordinating drones with each other, where they need to communicate extensively, is therefore a technically difficult problem.
Funken wie möglich. Und da ist natürlich die Koordination von Drohnen untereinander, die dann sozusagen ganze Zeit technischen Chatter haben, ein schwieriges Ding.
So, everyone is working on it. And in my view, this kind of scenario is clearly a nightmare scenario. The idea that machines could one day independently decide to kill people is something I personally find deeply problematic. But the reality is more complicated than what you might imagine in a lab or in theory. That was made very clear again recently. Over the past few weeks, I noticed reporting about humanoid robots that have now arrived in Ukraine. These are Phantom MK1 robots produced by a company that is described as a kind of American-German joint venture. These machines really do look like something out of Terminator. They are about 1.75 meters tall, black, and have an unsettling appearance. They are now in Ukraine and are being tested there for now. They are supposed to be used for supply missions, but in the future they may also be equipped to carry weapons. And that's when it starts to feel like something straight out of a science fiction film. Black humanoid robots with glowing eyes moving toward the front line, taking over the fighting for humans. I asked Gressel whether this is really the future of warfare or whether it's more of a show.
Also humanoide Roboter halte ich zum Großteil für Spielerei, ganz einfach. Nicht, weil ich sage, es wird nie Landroboter geben, die Infanterie versuchen werden, Infanterie zu ersetzen. Das wird es natürlich geben. Aber die Frage
overall,
ist,
I consider humanoid robots largely to be a gimmick. Not because I think there will never be ground robots attempting to replace infantry. Of course, there will be. But the question is, do they really need to look like humans? Like the biological form that evolved over hundreds of thousands of years as a kind of hairless ape? If I think purely in terms of the battlefield effect, then I would say, if I only need a weapon system, I don't need a human shape. A flat-tracked vehicle with its battery mounted low, and an arm, maybe a robotic or hydraulic arm, that can raise a weapon, presents a much smaller target. Its cross-sectional area is far smaller than that of a human being. It can also likely move across terrain with lower ground pressure and more stability than a walking humanoid robot. So, the question becomes, if I have a certain amount of battery capacity, how much of it is actually used just for locomotion? Because I insist on making it walk on two legs. Humanoid robots will probably have their place, especially in civilian applications like care work or service roles. Because many environments, like cities or our homes, are designed for humans. They are built for us to live in. Kitchens, bathrooms, everything is arranged for human use. In that context, a humanoid robot makes sense. For example, helping elderly people clean their kitchen, where it cannot just stay 30 centimeters off the ground. But if the task is simply to bring a machine gun into a firing position, then a low-profile robot that effectively sticks to the ground is actually a very good solution. So I think humanoid robots are one possible development path. But in the military domain, we will likely see highly specialized machines for specific applications, rather than human-shaped robots taking over the battlefield.
Wenn ich aber eigentlich nur Maschinengewehr in die Stellung bringen soll, dann ist ein Roboter, der eigentlich 30 Zentimeter über dem Boden klebt, eigentlich eine ganz gute Sache, aber der ist da unten nur hingehört. Also da denke ich, ist das natürlich eine Entwicklungsvariante, aber da werden sich spezialisierte Maschinen für die jeweilige Anwendung auftun.
He says very clearly that he does not consider it realistic that we will ever see something like in the Terminator films, humanoid robots marching into battle. In other words, he takes us away from the Terminator illusion. Of course, ground robots will continue to develop, and they are meant to replace certain tasks performed by infantry, but they don't need to look like humans. In fact, from a military perspective, it makes much more sense for them to be small, flat, and difficult to hit, rather than humanoid robot soldiers from science fiction. When you talk to drone pilots, engineers, and military personnel, you quickly get the impression that the future belongs entirely to drones. It can start to seem as if artillery, tanks, and fighter jets might be relics of the past, and that we are witnessing a technological revolution similar to the First World War, when tanks suddenly appeared on the battlefield. And just as cavalry, with horses, eventually disappeared from warfare, even though it still existed in the First World War and at the beginning of the Second World War, one might think that drone technology will completely replace these old systems, but Gressel does not believe that.
Also mechanisierte Kräfte können derzeit, die werden zwar eingesetzt und die haben noch ihren Kampfwert, aber die können natürlich nur in den Räumen agieren, die sozusagen die neuen Kräfte, also Drohnen, elektronische Kampfführung.
Mechanized forces are still being used today, and they still have combat value, but they can only operate in the spaces that are created for them by the new systems, drones, electronic warfare, and related capabilities. Without drone support, organizing an attack or even a defense is essentially a suicide mission, and this development is not going to be reversed. It's not as if drones will simply disappear. The technology is too mature for that. In a way, drones, as we see them today, are a product of the digital revolution. We can see this in our smartphones, how computing power has increased, how miniaturized systems and camera quality have improved. Today's smartphones contain cameras that produce images comparable to digital SLR cameras from the 2000s. That shows how much everything has shrunk and improved in performance. And this miniaturization, the increasing performance of electronic components and batteries, is exactly what makes it possible to militarize these technologies. The same applies to drones. This is not going away, and it's not going backward. At the moment, the side that is winning is the one that combines conventional firepower with drones and uses drones in a way that opens up opportunities for conventional forces to engage and eliminate the enemy. The question of when and whether drones will completely replace other weapon systems is, in my view, one that will unfold gradually over a long period of time, much more slowly than many people imagine.
Konventionelle Feuerkraft mit eben diesen Drohnen verbindet und die Drohnen so nutzt, dass sie den konventionellen Streitkräften auch Ansatzmöglichkeiten kriegen, den Feind zu killen. Wann und wo Drohnen vollständig andere Waffensysteme ersetzen, ich glaube, dass das selber wird ein gradueller und langsamerer Prozess werden, als wir uns das vorstellen haben.
Yes, that's certainly an important counter-argument to all the technological promises. As Gressel says, drones do not make conventional weapons obsolete, but without drones, tank and artillery operations today are extremely vulnerable. Drones are a product of the digital revolution, and they will not disappear any more than machine guns or artillery disappeared after the First World War. So instead of a single robot army, what we will likely see in the near future are mixed formations. Artillery, infantry fighting vehicles, infantry, and drones working together. Drones open up space for these units, conduct reconnaissance, strike targets deep in enemy territory, carry out evacuation missions, deliver supplies, and are used for a wide range of tasks as a complement to traditional weapon systems that have defined warfare up to the Ukraine war. When I think back on this episode, two images stand out. One is the officer describing how they once placed a wounded soldier onto a ground drone in minus 15 degrees Celsius, sending it 16 kilometers through the kill zone. Without that tracked vehicle, the man would simply have frozen to death. And beyond that, the ground robot ensured that his comrades did not have to risk their own lives to carry him out or be pulled away from their positions. In that sense, it is an extremely useful addition to the military arsenal. The other image is Gressel's view. Humanoid robots are largely a gimmick. What makes sense militarily is something small, flat, and hard to hit. 4 years after the beginning of the war in Ukraine, we are seeing things at the front that were almost unimaginable in 2022. When I first started reporting there, reconnaissance drones were used mainly to guide artillery and observe enemy movements. At that time, large mechanized formations with armored vehicles were still common. That has completely changed. The front has largely stagnated. There are hardly any territorial breakthroughs from either side because infantry can barely advance anymore. Large mechanized assaults with infantry fighting vehicles and tanks are almost non-existent because whenever they are attempted, especially by the Russians, they end in disaster as drones dominate the airspace. Ground robots are now being mass-produced. Drone units exist as their own branch within the Ukrainian armed forces, and there is extensive experimentation with artificial intelligence. At the same time, artillery and infantry are still fighting over the same villages, and perhaps that is exactly the new reality of war. It is becoming more digital, but it remains brutally analog. Machines that save lives, machines that kill, and much of what is being tested here will not stay in Ukraine. Gressel says that without drone support, an attack today is essentially a suicide mission. I would add, without understanding this, every political decision is made in the dark. And that is something soldiers and engineers I speak with in Ukraine repeatedly emphasize. They say we must continue developing this technology because the enemy, Russia, is doing the same, and falling behind is not an option. But at the same time, they also hope that global politics will finally set some boundaries, that guardrails will be put in place, and that at some point a stop button will be pressed globally before we enter a development that can no longer be controlled and where no one knows where it might ultimately lead. This was Crisis Mode, a podcast by the Funke Media Group. This episode was produced by Alexander Baumeister, who is also a journalist at Funke's radio station. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen, and feel free to leave a rating. If you have ideas for future episodes or questions about this one, you can reach us at chrisandmodus@funkemedian.d. Thanks for listening, stay alert, take care, and see you next time.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Ein Podcast von Funke.